composition by Larry Gray of the University of Illinois faculty. He's the double bass faculty member, and this is also his trio performing here. Jim Trumpeter, the pianist, and Dana Hall, the drummer. The tune is called To Wait. Here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, the show is your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly. And coming up, we will be talking with a jazz drummer who's bringing his trio to the Eastern Illinois University in Charleston to work with the jazz ensemble there as part of the 55th annual EIU Jazz Festival taking place Friday and Saturday. But first on the program, we have four of the important people involved in a current production at the University of Illinois Department of Theater. Unusually for the Department of Theater, neither of the two actors are students in the program. And the director, although he is on faculty, is also very well renowned for his credentials throughout the theater world, on Broadway, off Broadway. He's a Tony Award winner. And as is our playwright, his name David Auburn. The play is called Lost Lake. It's a brand new one. And the director, Daniel Sullivan, our actors, Opal Aladin and Jake Weber. Thank you all very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
First, I want to ask Dan Sullivan, this is being billed as the first production of The Sullivan Project. And it took me a while to actually find what exactly is The Sullivan Project. So rather than my telling people, why don't you do it?
Yeah, well, that gives me a little twinge of embarrassment just to have a project named after me. But it's actually, it happened because at the time when we decided to start doing productions or developing new work on a professional basis, we didn't have a play. So we couldn't say it was Lost Lake. So they called it the Sullivan Project instead. So, but we are going to do, for 3 years running, we're going to do projects like this where we bring in playwrights with new work and develop them here with professional actors, professional designers and lighting designers, scene designers and costume designers. And try to put up a well-made piece.
And the idea of doing this in an educational institution like University of Illinois?
I sort of looked around and found here we are about 2.5 hours from Chicago, and our student actors are extremely busy, not able to get up to Chicago very often. So they didn't really have models, and I thought it would be a good idea to bring professional actors in, to have professional actors in classes, to be able to have rehearsals where the students could come in and observe the entire process, and that includes our technical students, our design students, et cetera, who have been around and very much involved with the creation of this piece.
Is this piece a finished product, or is it still a work in progress?
Well, I'll have Dave answer that.
It's kind of both. I mean, that's one of the nice things about this project. I mean, this is a fully realized production, a very beautiful one, which is unusual. But it's also a workshop. So I've been tinkering all the way along with the play. I think I've made the last set of changes I made yesterday, and the actors were, you know, nice enough to put them in and do them that night, you know, before the audience. So I have that flexibility, but we also have this sort of solidity of a fully realized production with a beautiful set and lights. So it's a nice marriage of both of those things.
Tell us a little bit about the play, Lost Lake.
It's about Veronica and Hogan, two people who meet when Veronica rents Hogan's ramshackle lakeside cabin for the summer. She's come up from New York City and she wants to give her kids a little vacation. And Hogan, even though he says he's gonna leave her the cabin and make way for her vacation, ends up sort of hanging around. And the play's about what happens over the course of this week between them as they each sort of get dragged into one another's worlds a little bit and pulled into each other's problems. And they learn about each other's lives and become entangled with one another, and a kind of uneasy friendship develops, and that's sort of what the play is about.
Can you describe any particular inspiration for the play? I mean, did it come from your own experience or not, someone else's experience?
Part of it came from just this initial impulse to write a negotiation between two people, this kind of tense negotiation over money and renting this place and making those two people as different as possible so that you have a feeling that, you know, what's behind this negotiation is a lot of different assumptions on both of their parts. But I guess the other sort of feeling about the play was that there's a certain kind of person who you sometimes encounter, and maybe they're the loquacious or overly talkative, you know, guy at the end of the bar who begins talking to you, and you begin to get a sense of their lives, and maybe they share a little too much, and you get a glimpse of some real complications and struggles in someone else's life, and you have that question of how much do I get involved in this? Is this something I should care about at all? If this person's in trouble, do I have any business even asking about it? So that ended up, and I didn't start with that, but that ended up kind of informing the play, and Hogan became that kind of character.
I wanted to ask Dan Sullivan, who's of course directing this play, to open the Sullivan Project. You've worked before with David Auburn, a play called Proof that won. I actually forget, did it win for best play? I know you won for best director of a play. Did it do both?
Yeah.
So obviously a very successful collaboration. Did you choose this play and this playwright specifically for this occasion, in part because of that success?
Well, remember I was doing the Sullivan Project, right. And I didn't have a play. And I mentioned to Dave what I was doing, and we were just having lunch. And after we had lunch, I called him and said, "Oh, you mentioned that you were working on a play." And I said, "What about coming out to Illinois and doing it?" And that's how that happened. It was really just on my mind at that point, and I knew Dave had the play.
It was good timing.
Yeah, it was very good timing.
Well, these things often are, aren't they, I guess? Yeah. And what's been your role in helping to shape the play, since you're catching it right at the beginning, which I imagine doesn't always happen?
Well, my role was in talking Opal and Jake into doing it. That would be one thing, getting them to come out here. And we were very lucky to have them. And they have been very helpful in putting this together. I know they've been very helpful to Dave because they're so good at what they do that he can fix as he goes. And he's getting, you know, a wonderful reading of the play by these two. And I just do what I normally do in a rehearsal room, which is basically ask questions, both of the actors and of Dave. And that's how we put it together.
Well, I imagine it's a little more complicated than that because, and we will maybe explore some, but I want to ask also, you said you were lucky enough to have found these two actors. What made you choose these two actors for this particular? Well, I mean, there's a lot of actors in the world.
Yeah, but I know the work of both these actors, and you know, just the fact that they would come out here for 5 weeks in the middle of the winter was astounding to me, because they're, you know, so excellent and work all the time. So we were very lucky to get them. But it was because of what I knew of them that we made the offer.
Opal Aladin and Jake Weber, of course, you're the actors we're talking about here. We might as well let you chime in. You both have a lot of Broadway, off-Broadway film and TV credentials. Did you know anything about the play before you were asked to come and participate in it?
Well, I auditioned and read the play, of course, before auditioning, and was drawn to it immediately, and already a big fan of David and Dan. So it was just a great project to, you know, even be a part of.
What drew you to it?
these two characters, the whole play, these two characters and the journey of discovery that they have, you know, two very disparate people that you wouldn't think would maybe become friends, or friendly, or even to just get a glimpse into each other's lives. I think that was what really drew me to it.
Jake?
I did not know of the play before, and I think what always draws actors to projects is the writing and the direction. Dan is, you know, one of the best directors in the business, and you know, David won a Pulitzer Prize for Proof, and is, you know, I was completely blown away by that play when I saw it, and it's a beautiful play. It's moving. It's funny. And it's quick, it's short, and it packs a punch, and it's a short commitment, because it's only 5 weeks, so we can go back and do what we do, which is try to get jobs and pilot season and all that stuff, real world stuff. And this is what the actors do for fun. They go off and do plays with extraordinary people.
What's the creation of the play been like for you? And maybe let me back up a little bit. What's been the gestation period for all of you together? Not necessarily the gestation period for writing the play, but for the process of creating it as four collaborators.
Well, it starts, I mean, Dan could speak to this, but it starts with four of us sitting around a table and reading the play. And that was about, I guess, a month ago. And that's the first time I hear it with the actors. And you just start to dive into it and talk about everything that's going on with these people and what's happening in the story and connecting the dots from one moment in the play to another. And, you know, I have a history with Dan. I've worked with him on, this is the third play we've done together. And Opal and I think I've known Opal for 15 years because we were at Juilliard at the same time, mm-hmm. and I've known her work. So there's a history there. Jake and I have never met, but I'd seen his work before. So, you know, you just spend some time getting used to one another, listening to one another's reactions, and trying to get a handle on what some of the questions in the play might be. And after a certain point, I go away, the actors get up on their feet, and they're with Dan, and Dan then, you know, sends me questions, asks me for clarification, I send in changes. It's a nice sort of process, and then I can come back and check in with what they've done.
Is it an important part of the process for you to go away?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, for one thing, I find it's boring for a playwright to sit and watch that kind of sausage getting made, you know, for watching them work through the scenes. And I don't know that it's particularly helpful for the director or for the actors to have the playwright there at that stage. I mean, they need to figure out a lot of things for themselves and then ask me when they run into roadblocks or places where the writing isn't clear. So, and then it's you know, by the same token, it's useful for me to come in not having watched them grind through the whole thing, but to be able to come in and sort of see the process they've arrived at, watch it, react to it. So that seems to work pretty well.
Opal and Jake, the process for you of becoming the characters, whether it's these characters or just characters in general, do you subscribe to a particular method, and I don't necessarily mean that one, in creating a character, particularly creating a character that no one else has created before?
I don't think there's any sort of set formula. It's a dynamic that happens in the rehearsal room with the writing, the text, the director, and the other actor you're working with. You don't really come in with any preconceived notions, or if you do, they disappear pretty quickly. Like if you have an idea, you're on the first reading and you have an idea, there's almost nothing left of this performance that was in the first reading. It's a process, it's a journey, and you don't know where it's going to end, and you really don't know where it's going to start.
Do you have any example to illustrate what you just said, that nothing that happened early is still there. I put it in slightly different words, but you know, maybe something that seemed to you to be one way, and then as you discovered it more, something changed.
Well, I had the idea early on that this man had sort of manic depressive elements to his personality, and that the manic aspect was probably going to be fairly enjoyable for an audience because he was so up and enthusiastic, and then when he takes a fall, that would coincide with some of the aspects of manic depression. But he's actually, as we've worked on it, those really aren't his issues. He has other issues, and so that that aspect, that notion that I had, is no longer useful.
Partly because it's not as entertaining as you thought.
No,
that
it's just
part
simply
would be?
It's simply not true. Mm. It's simply not the character. It's not the guy. It was something that I hooked onto right away, that occurred to me, but it ended up not being useful in the through line of who he is and where he goes, and I don't want to give away where he goes, but there's a journey that he takes that if he is suffering from a disease such as manic depression, it just doesn't track.
Opal, do you have any sort of corollary situation for
well,
yourself?
I would say the difference between doing a project like this where you're creating something from the ground up is that we have, we're able to go to Dave and ask, you know, if we come into a roadblock that I don't understand something about this character or don't understand something about the story, that we just have the great opportunity to go to the playwright and ask and just suss something out. You know, that's the difference between doing a work that's already published.
Do you feel any reluctance to ask those questions? I mean, or is there a point in the creation where you feel like you're getting a handle on it and you want to create on your own without the interference? I realize that's two questions.
Yeah. No, I would say, no, not at all. I would say that I feel like it's part of my job to really work with everything that he has there on the page and figure it out and find different ways into it. And so, it's been great to be able to go and ask if I've really come to a roadblock and I don't understand something. It's been great to have that here.
Dave Auburn is the composer of this play, and I use the term composer partly because, in the world of opera, you often will see in some singer's bio, they will say very proudly, "I created the role of such and such," meaning that they were the first ones to perform it, and so that's what these two actors are doing. Are there times when you have created this play and you wrote what's on the page, as Opal said, but there are things that they found that aren't on the page, but may not have been things that you thought were there?
Sure, all the time. And, you know, good actors always ask questions that you don't know the answer to or that make you realize that you hadn't thought about some aspect of the scene or of the characters and that you need to sort of take a step back and rethink it from the point of view of the person who's doing that thing, who has to play that scene or say that line. And that's what, you know, that's why there's no substitute for the rehearsal process and the production process. I mean, I always have this fantasy that I could sit at my desk and if I just work hard enough, I could produce a play that's finished, you know, that I've really answered all the questions, but that's impossible. You need that collaboration. You need those other people coming into the process and opening it up for you.
Dan Sullivan, who's directing the play, and let's just remind listeners, we're talking about a play called Lost Lake. It's a new one by David Auburn. It opened last night at the Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana, and will continue for a week. I'll tell you all the performances as when we finish. But Dan said, we're talking about questions now a lot. Actors ask questions. You try to answer questions and may not be able to, Dave. But Dan said his role is to ask questions as a director. And both of our actors have said that you really admire Dan's work. What is there about the questions that he asks that, in your experience, through this play or just from seeing him work in other situations, that are the sort of thing that makes a Tony Award-winning director?
I don't know why. I can't speak to prizes and stuff like that, but I will say what I think his particular strengths are as a director. First is his very rigorous thinking, and serving the play. So everything is tracked very meticulously. So everything is the trajectory of the play is very, very carefully considered. And he is, he does a lot of the work that an actor usually has to do on their own. He comes up with moments, with ideas. And the thing about working in the theater is the director is usually 90% of the time the smartest person in the room. And that isn't always the case in film and television. In fact, it very rarely is. You will actually be given a large portion of your performance by him. Some of it you might discover, you know, in the course of a long run, but he is a catalyst for discovery, and he's just really smart. He's really good, truly extraordinary as a director. I wish he didn't have to be here to hear that, but...
Opal. No, I kind of like the name Sullivan Project.
Opal, is part of what Jake described as his giving you so much of the play of your character, does that come as a result of the questions he says he asks? Or is it really more than what he said, than what Dan said about his own work?
I think Dan has, gosh, how do you explain that? He just has the rigorous thinking, I think, is as Jake just said, he has a keen understanding of where something needs to go to make the story make sense. And so far in this experience, he's always had the right answer. Every time I've had a question, it's always just enlightened and, you know, made me, challenged me and made me go to go deeper into the character to figure something out.
So in asking a question, if it's the right leading question, it leads to your own personal discovery.
Absolutely.
What your character is.
Absolutely.
About, motivations, mm-hmm. and more. The play is called Lost Lake. It's directed by Daniel Sullivan, written by David Auburn, being created this week by our two actors, Opal Aladin and Jake Weber, and it opened last night. The remaining performances are tonight and tomorrow at 7:30, Saturday at both 2 and 7:30, and the same on Sunday. Those are your opportunities. It's at the Studio Theater, the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana, and always a really intimate place to see plays, and especially to see a play where there's just two people really interacting very intimately with each other. Thanks all very much for coming in and sharing a little bit about this process with our audience here on Live and Local.
Thank you.
You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our program is made possible by Sinfonia da Camera, presenting From Russia with Love on Friday, February 14th at 7:30 p.m. in the Follinger Great Hall at Krannert. Violinist Andres Cardenas joins Sinfonia to perform works by Prokofiev, Stravinsky, and Tchaikovsky. Coming up next, a conversation with jazz drummer Dennis McCrell, who's going to be bringing his trio to Eastern Illinois University in Charleston to work with the jazz ensemble there as part of their jazz festival. Here is Dennis as part of the Bill Charlop Trio, a composition by Charlie Parker. It's called Confirmation. Thank you. is a tune by Charlie Parker called Confirmation, recorded back in 1995 by the Bill Charlop Trio, with Bill Charlop on piano, Scott Colley on bass, and for the purposes of our conversation, this portion of Live and Local, the drummer is Dennis McCrell from the CD called Souvenir. He's going to be appearing with his trio with the Eastern Illinois University Jazz Ensemble Friday night as part of their 55th annual jazz festival. Saturday constitutes having a bunch of high school and junior high school bands come in and perform, and he'll do a clinic or two, and they'll so they've got a concert Friday night and then a mini concert on Saturday. He's my guest this portion of the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The first thing that sort of stood out in your resume to me was your relationship with the Count Basie Orchestra. I love to hear, and you must be really, certainly must have been flattered at the time to know that you were the last drummer to have been hired by Count Basie personally. The Basie Orchestra has been around under the leadership of many others, including you for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how that happened.
Well, for the most part, my association with the Basie Orchestra goes back to the early 80s, and it started because when I was a student in college, I went to the University of Nevada in Las Vegas, and as luck would just so have it, Joe Williams lived in Las Vegas.
Joe Williams, the great vocalist.
That's correct. And in a way, he did a few things. He did many things, but probably two of the most important things he did for me was, A, introduce me to Mr. Basie, but also he kind of instilled the mentor student relationship. For example, Joe, although he lived in Las Vegas, he never was affiliated directly with the university, but he would just come up and sometimes just check out our rehearsals, or if there was a concert, you know, he would be in the audience, and if it looked like we needed an MC, he'd just jump on stage and take over, because he really had a very strong interest not only in the music but in the younger musicians who were trying to figure it out. And so he knew me from school, and then when there was an opening on the Basie Orchestra, he spoke to Basie personally and recommended me.
So in a way, he gave you not only your first really big gig, but also, it sounds like, instilled in you, or at least got you started on a lifelong journey as somebody who has mentored a lot of other musicians over the years.
You know, the thing that I really, that I guess was very clear with Joe, was that music is not only just something that, you know, you do as an occupation. It's really like a lifelong commitment, and it's a learning, it's a learning process that never really ends. And, you know, watching him was an education, but more specifically, you could just tell the personal connection that he had with all of the younger musicians who were trying to figure it out. He would never be too busy to, you know, to talk to us or just to kind of hang out with us or just encourage us. And I think that when you experience that on you know, at any point in your life, you can't help but, you know, want to do the same thing to younger musicians the older you get.
And we'll talk more about that later, because of course we're talking about an educational situation at Eastern Illinois University, where you're playing with the ensemble and then also doing some clinics, and I'll be interested to know some of what might happen there from your point of view. But just to sort of finish the Count Basie story, he died about a year after he hired you, and the band's been under the leadership of various other people since then. You were with it for a while, and then most interested that you came back in, was it 2010?
That's correct.
To lead them yourself for a few years. What makes the Basie Orchestra still the Basie Orchestra with Count Basie gone since, what, 1984?
Well, Basie was a master musician, but he also was somebody who was very, very forward in his thinking. And I think that his concept that was very, very clear whenever you saw the band. He saw the band almost like a machine. And one of the most famous records, or one of the records that I almost kind of used as a textbook blueprint, as far as how the band should function, was chairman of the board. And I use that as a reference because he really almost ran the band like a company that could function on its own. If you're a fan of Basie's style, you know that he never really played that much. And a lot of it was because musically that was very effective and very hip, just to put it out there. But it was also something to where he wanted to make sure that the band could function and kind of run by itself. So, you know, when my association with the band started, I really saw that all of the leaders kind of kept that in mind to where, you know, the band would kind of be able to stand on its own two feet. They were more like managers or, in fact, chairman of the board and, let the band go and do what it's going to do. So, again, when I came back as a leader, I tried to really think of it more as not so much something that you have to really do a whole lot in terms of up and conducting and waving your arms and all that kind of thing, but more like a coach or like an organizer. And usually if anyone ever saw me conducting the band, they would see me count the tune off or introduce the tune and get out the way and just let them play.
Dennis McCrell, my guest here on Live and Local. He's going to be appearing with his trio and the Eastern Illinois University Jazz Ensemble Friday night 7:30 at the Doudna Fine Arts Center on the Eastern Campus in Charleston. I want to talk about other collaborations, and particularly the small band, the trio collaborations. But let's hear an example of that first. We did hear one, but this is a very different one. This is the Hank Jones Trio. Hank Jones on piano, George Mraz, does he say?
That's right.
On bass, and then you're on the drums from 2005, when I guess Hank Jones, all of 86 years old or something like that. Mm-hmm. And this tune is called But for the Grace. Let's give it a listen, and then we'll come back and chat a bit more. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Thank you. But for the Grace, lovely tune by Harold, does he say Mayburn?
Mayburn, that's correct.
Mayburn, recorded by the Hank Jones Trio off from their CD called For My Father in 2005. The drummer, Dennis McCrell, who's my guest here on Live and Local, and you joined the Basie band. Later you worked with a lot of other big bands like the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra, American Jazz Orchestra, and Dizzy Gillespie All-Star Big Band. But then a lot of work as a member of a trio or other small ensembles.
Mm-hmm.
What is different about, now we're going to talk about the role of a drummer,
mm-hmm.
between a big band and, say, a trio?
Well, the one analogy that I like to give is basically, if you think about like a pilot of an aircraft, if you're flying a very small, nimble airplane, you can be a little bit more adventurous in terms of, you know, diving, and your turns can be a little bit quicker. But if you're flying like a large aircraft, it just moves a little bit slower. So you kind of have to telegraph what you're going to do in advance a little bit. You try not to get too cute or too tricky with a jumbo jet, as opposed to like a small Piper cub or something. And so for me as a drummer, I'm always aware in a big band that I have a great deal of responsibility in making sure that everybody, that many people know what's going on and where we are and what I'm doing, as opposed to a trio. If it's just, you know, a trio or a quartet or a smaller group, you can kind of, for lack of a better phrase, you can stop or you can turn on a dime, and it's not going to throw everybody.
In a minute, we're going to hear sort of a long solo of yours that happens to be with a big band, but it's just you for a while. Many of our listeners, I'm sure, who are jazz fans, will know the drummer Buddy Rich, for example, as somebody who I might describe, perhaps erroneously, as a fairly aggressive drummer and quite a bit of a showman. I've seen a couple of videos of you, and you seem to be fairly laid back, just visually, and quite a different sort of drummer. How would you describe what you do, technically is the wrong word, but how would you describe yourself as a drummer?
I like to feel that I am kind of, in a way, as I said, like as being a conductor, a conduit between whatever the music or the composer, whatever the needs of the music are kind of, I'm supposed to be the one to try to translate that into real time. As far as people describing my style, one thing I've heard people say is that, which I'm very, very flattered, is elegant. And I take that naturally as a compliment. I think where that comes from is that I try to be economical in my in motion. I don't believe that, I think that the drums are an elegant instrument, and I don't think that it's supposed to be labor to play them. I think that if you're doing it right, it shouldn't look like you're doing anything strenuous or that it's very difficult. So I try to get as much out of the instrument as I can in terms of economy of motion, and try not to make it look like I'm just doing too much.
Well, it occurred to me that I could have asked the question another way, and I think the way you ended up answering it probably would have answered this question as well, which is, how would you coach other drummers to work? You know, what would you find to be the most important things that you would have them do, which might really have answered the same question? Would you answer that any differently than you just did?
Probably a little shorter. I apologize for. In a way, I think my fundamental background as a sideman. I mean, that's really what I am. I kind of make a joke, and I consider myself the Spider-Man of jazz. And what I mean by that is that, you know, like a superhero like that, you're not supposed to know who it is. You're just supposed to see the results of what he's done. And for me, as a sideman and playing with so many different people, what I try to do is to find out what is the most important thing that I what like what my function is, and to make sure that I do it in a more transparent behind the scenes way as possible. So for younger players, in terms of just like playing the drums, I try to impress upon them that it's really not about you at all. You're really supposed to be playing for somebody else, and the best drummers, in my opinion, are usually the ones that you never really see. You just like the way the band sounds. So I try to make sure that they are not too flashy. And I think technically that's kind of one reason why my style, people say it hardly looks like I'm playing at all. Because I think if what I'm doing is distracting you from the music, then I'm doing something wrong.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to a long opening solo for your own arrangement of a pretty familiar tune to jazz fans called Lester Leaps In. This was recorded live in concert in 2007 with a Danish group called the Kluvers Big Band. And we'll get into the tune a little bit, but mostly I want people to hear an example of what you sound like when you're on your own. It's Dennis McCrell here on Live and Local. Lester Leaps In, the name of the tune, of which we only heard a fraction, really. I wanted you to hear the opening drum solo by the arranger, in this case, Dennis McCrell, with the Kluvers Big Band of Denmark. And heard here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Dennis McCrell going to be playing with and doing some coaching of the Eastern Illinois University Jazz Ensemble. The concert's tomorrow night at 7:30, and then on Saturday, high school and junior high school jazz bands are coming in. He'll give a clinic at noon, then there'll be a short version of the concert at 1 o'clock, and then more school groups will play throughout the afternoon. When you do come to a situation like this, well, I should say that you do have a number of official faculty member positions, the Skidmore Jazz Institute in New York and the Birch Creek Summer jazz camp in Wisconsin. When you come into a situation like this, which I think you do fairly often, how do you work quickly with a group that you have for such a short period of time?
Well, fortunately, the state of jazz education is pretty high, and usually by the time I get there, the directors of the bands have, you know, had a chance to have rehearsed the music. And I've never been in a situation yet where, you know, I've come and they weren't prepared. So I'm not, it's a little bit difficult to answer that question. I guess the usually what happens is that, for example, we'll start to rehearse, and I think that like was in the case with Joe, you know, you can talk and talk and talk, but how you conduct yourself or the example that you set speaks volumes. And I've been very, very fortunate in that to be able to come to, you know, to a school like Eastern Illinois. I've been in contact with Sam Fegley for several weeks now. We've been going back and forth with music. So my job in a lot of these cases, the situation is very, very easy, very easy. I just kind of play. And if there's anything that needs to be discussed in terms of the music, you know, the arrangement, something like that, we just handle that very quickly.
So the concert Friday night will include some performances by the EIU Jazz Ensemble on their own. They're going to have some with just you and your trio, and then some where the trio sort of fronts the band, right?
Yes. Basically, the format's going to be I'll perform with the big band, and then the trio will play. And I wanted to take a second and really let everyone know that the two gentlemen that are going to be joining me, Jeff Campbell, who is the director of jazz studies at Eastman School of Music, is going to be playing bass, and Reggie Thomas, who is teaching at the Michigan State University. So I'm coming along with some pretty big guns in terms of educators. They're wonderful musicians and great educators as well.
Well, you've worked with many big guns yourself over the years. We mentioned Basie up front, and have become one such person yourself. And I'm sure that the Eastern band and the audience will really appreciate having the chance to see you at work. And folks are welcome to check out YouTube. Dennis McCrell you can see him at work on there as well anytime you like. Last name spelled M-A-C-K-R-E-L, or he's got a wonderful website as well. Let's go out with another arrangement of yours. It's called No Frills, composed and arranged, I should say, with a group called the Manhattan Symphony Jazz Orchestra, this recording from the late 90s. And it's been a pleasure to talk with you here on Live and Local.
It has been my pleasure. I really am looking forward to coming, and I hope that for all of your listeners, that they'll come, mainly to support the band, because, as I said, I'll never forget how important it was for someone like Joe Williams to come and just kind of hang out and be there so we could develop. And I'm excited to be able to do something like that with the musicians, and I hope that there's a large audience that can appreciate everything that they're trying to do and support them as well.
Thank you very much. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Afraid that's all we'll have time to hear of that great tune, No Frills, composed and arranged by Dennis McCrell here on Live and Local. Our broadcast today is made possible with the support from these business partners: Natural Gourmet of Champaign, Roland Realty of Champaign, and Strategic Farm Marketing, also of Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WYLL in making great programs possible. We thank you very much. Programs on WYLL are made possible also with the support of the Friends of WYLL and in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, an agency of the state of Illinois. On tomorrow's program, live in our studio, clarinetist Karen DeBush, and also one of the 10 tenors who will be singing in Springfield this weekend, and also soprano Julia Bullock, who will be in Urbana also this weekend. This is 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois.